Hello, and welcome to Little Steps, Big Futures, the podcast that brings you all things early years. Each week, we chat to some incredible guests with amazing stories, talk about childcare tips, and delve into some controversial topics. I'm Aoife Murphy.
And I'm Jenny McCarty.
Let's get started.
Welcome back to the podcast, everyone. And this week, we're very excited to have Dr. Emma O'Brien on to speak to us. Emma is a chartered senior clinical psychologist, and she's going to talk to us a small bit about responsive caregiving. Some of you might know her as the mothering psychologist as well. So welcome to the podcast, Emma. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be on the podcast. And thanks for inviting me on as well to chat about such an important topic too.
Yeah, we're very excited to talk about it. And I think it's something that, you know, hasn't really crossed my path at all. And it's something that's going to be very valuable to parents and educators while they listen. But before we get stuck into the topic itself, can you just tell us a little bit about you and who you are as a person?
Yeah, so I'm Emma, obviously. And I suppose I'm a clinical psychologist and I'm also a first-time mommy. I suppose things have kind of changed a little bit, because obviously before I've been working with children, but not as a parent. And now I see things very, very differently, I have to say, as a parent in my work. So I find that now when I think about things, it's the psychologist hat comes on and the mommy hat, you know, the two things come together. And I suppose I'm trying to use that now to work with families and to work with parents from that approach of kind of the me too side of it, that I get it. I understand why that's tricky. I understand why that's hard. And a big part for me is getting information out there to parents. You know, I found when I became a parent that even with my background and even all the knowledge that I had, it was a minefield. And there's so much information out there, and it's all so contradictory that I couldn't tell the wood from the trees, you know. So I think it's really important for me now as a psychologist come on and describe that to parents in a way maybe that's easier to understand. I'm going to realize that parenting isn't easy. It's really hard, even if you're armed with all the knowledge that you need behind you.
Yeah, and you definitely have a new perspective, I suppose, on how you deliver information to parents. It's something in the childcare world, in the education world, that we may not always think about when we're kind of trying to explain. If, you know, you see something that you think is a red flag with the child, or you're trying to explain something to a parent. So would you say that you kind of think twice then about how you deliver information?
Definitely. And I think a big thing is being realistic about what parents can do. You know, like I know before when I worked with parents, I would have in my head said, you know, she'll only take 10 minutes to do that. And fair enough, it might only take 10 minutes, but that parent might not have 10 minutes. Do you know, like my husband does laugh at me here sometimes because something won't go into plan. And he'll say, sure, it's only 5 minutes. And I go, but you don't understand, that 5 minutes now has implications for this and for that and for the other. So I think being just really realistic about what parents can actually do. And I suppose I would have always liked to have felt that I was kind and compassionate towards parents. But I think really now I'd come at that from a whole other perspective, that I would really get it if they said, I didn't get to that, and it's really, really hard. And I think we can be so protective of our little ones and our little babies that I can understand now from another perspective as well, how hard it must be for a parent to come to me and say, I think my child has a problem. Like, I think that's a really big thing to say.
And we've spoken to many parents who will say work in the line of childcare and, you know, like yourself, psychology as well, and different aspects of it. And a lot of them say, you know, that they'd always thinking, right, I'm not going to be that parent that's saying this or that. And then you have a child and that all changes. And, you know, they said it's not until you actually have a child that you understand that part of it as well, you know. So do you kind of find like it has added to, I suppose, your role as a psychologist, being a parent?
Definitely. And just what you're saying there, Jennifer, I've learned that I will never say never now when it comes to parenting. There'll be no, I'd never do this, I'd never do that, because we just don't know. And I think the big thing for me in working with parents is letting them know that the books aren't always real life. And a big thing is that social media isn't always real life. Like, these are ideals. And I always say to parents, Now I see there is no such thing as a textbook baby. You don't get a manual when you take your baby home. You know, you're learning as you go, and that's okay. And I think a big thing is that it's okay to make mistakes. There's too much of a push, I think, for parents to have to do everything perfect or do it just right. And I think something I suppose I hadn't really thought about before, but that parents feel that if they make a mistake, which we all do, that it could be damaging to their child. And that's really, really scary for them. And they're nearly half afraid then to try something with them. So I think that's kind of thing that I kind of keep in mind now when I'm working with parents.
Yeah, and just to touch on the social media aspect there, you know, you have very influential figures who have kids. And as you were saying, if a mistake is made, you know, they have such a big platform to kind of say, look, this was my parenting fail this week. Just because there are so many women out there who do look up to these women who are kind of, let's say, I'm using air quotes, like, you know, famous and showing a perfect life. But that's not always the reality, as obviously you found as a first time mom as well.
Yeah. And I think it's so important to share that. Like, I only realized in the past couple of weeks, I think, because obviously the psychologist hat is always there, I can't turn it off. I will be very, very focused on my little one, Lottie, and how she's doing. And I completely forgotten about myself. And I didn't make time for me to look after myself. And even something as simple like going to get my hair cut last week, you know, and the poor hairdresser, I sat in the chair and she says, well, what do you want? And I said, well, I want my hair long. And she said, well, you booked in for a haircut. Like, what do you want? And I hadn't even thought about it. You know, all those little things that I think we can overlook, but social media makes it look easy, doesn't it? I think where, you know, you should be able to juggle all these things. It shouldn't be such a big deal for you to be able to just go and get your hair cut. Like, why is that a big problem? When it actually is a big deal to try and do that and organize it. Like, it sounds ridiculous, but for me, it was nearly like a military operation, like to have my husband timed of when he was going to be able to mind Lottie and I could go and have my hair done and be back to feed her. Like, it sounds silly, but that's the reality of it.
Exactly. And I'm not a parent myself, but I often think if we have a child in here that's sick or anything and you pick up the phone to ring the parent and all, you're just in my own head as a manager and I'm thinking, oh God, this is just going to completely put a stop in this parent's day, you know, and just the kind of knock on effect that it has on, you know, your work life and your home life and your family life. Like, it's, I don't know how you balance it all. So you definitely need to take the treat of getting your hair done. And, you know, we've often spoken before how you can't actually, you know, fill your child's cup if your cup is empty as well. So, you know, you have to take care of yourself. But just moving on a small bit, Emma, have you always been interested in working with children and where did that kind of passion come from?
Yeah, so I suppose it's really funny because I've asked my mom about this before because I always see myself working with children. So I was curious about what it was like when I was little. And my mom said that I was a people watcher number one. That was a big thing with me. But it was like, she used to jokingly call me the Pied Piper. She said I was like a magnet for children, that children were drawn to me. So like, and I even have memories of this, like we could be sitting like maybe in the doctor's surgery waiting for an appointment or out in a shopping center and a little child would toddle over and hop up on my knee, a complete stranger. And I just kind of had a way with them, I guess. And I think that's where I came from. And I genuinely just love the fun of working with kids. I think psychology can be a very demanding profession and a very serious profession as well. And as demanding as it is, I love how you can see so much change with children. And even in a situation that seems so tough and so difficult, and parents maybe can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, a little kid will do something as simple as laugh or pull a funny face or do something. And it just changes the room just like that with something so simple. So I think that's kind of where it came from. I just genuinely really love working with children.
Yeah. And, you know, we ask that question to a lot of people and it's nearly a carbon copy answer. There's something, I think people have, you know, certain people who work with children definitely have something in them that just draws children to them. And then they have just this kind of way of working with children. So it's funny, we like to hear the different answers, but they're always pretty much the same in a different kind of, you know, how it's explained. But, you know, clinical psychology is something that we studied in college. Well, I did anyway. But what was the, you know, what was the pull to psychology for you? Then you said you had an interest in working with children and then you went into the field of psychology. So how did you put those kind of two hand in hand?
Yeah, so for me, it was, I always asked why about people. From when I was little, it was always, why do they do this and why do they do that? And I suppose that had always been the back of my mind from when I was young. But then when it came to transition year in secondary school, I had a placement in a hospice. And I was actually there at that stage to be placed alongside an occupational therapist, not a psychologist at all. And just by chance, one day the occupational therapist wasn't free to bring me around for the day, and they put me with a psychologist. And it was literally like this eureka moment. Like, and I have really strong memories of it in my head. I remember walking into the room and meeting a few of the people who were in the hospice, and the way the day went, when I came home that day, it was all I could talk about. And my mind was weighed up. I was only 16. And I was like, that's what I want to do. I want to be a psychologist. I now had a name for what I wanted to do. And I think that's kind of at that stage, my mind was just made up. And I've heard from an awful lot of psychologists that would have trained with me as well, that there is that kind of all of a sudden eureka moment, that that's what you want to do. And you're all of a sudden very, very passionate about it. I think you have to be fair, to become a psychologist, particularly if you want to be a clinical psychologist, because it's so competitive. There's so many years of study and work experience to get to the end goal. But that's where it came from for me.
And I guess when you say end goal there, I could imagine that there's always something new that you need to be studying or learning about or kind of keeping up to date. So I'd imagine that the end goal kind of keeps getting further and further away. Maybe when you retire now, Emma, you might reach it. But for those of us, I guess, listening to you saying a clinical psychologist, could you just give us, I know it's probably, you could nearly do a thesis on what a clinical psychologist does, but can you just give us kind of a brief outline for those of us who don't know?
Yeah, so I suppose we apply theory and an evidence-based practice, right, to promote psychological well-being. So that's across the lifespan. So from babies up to the elderly, okay? But I suppose what we're doing always is that we are looking at emotional, behavioral, and cognitive aspects. So your cognitive is kind of your thinking, but it's also your intellectual ability and things like that as well. And our idea, our role, I suppose, is that we identify if there is some sort of problem there, and we try to break it down into a way that's understandable for the parent or the child or the adult. And then we support them around what they might do to help them with that problem. So say, for example, if a parent came to me with their child and they said to me, my child is really, really anxious and I don't know why, I don't know what to do. My role as a clinical psychologist is to actually, first of all, find out, are they presenting with anxiety? Is this the right thing that we're looking at? Have a look at their behavior. What are they doing that tells me that they're anxious? And what can I then do to help them with that anxiety? So whether that's working with parents to change maybe their parenting strategies or teach them coping strategies to work with them, or else I'd work directly with the child as well to teach them coping strategies and emotion regulation.
And I suppose if there's somebody listening who kind of wants to get into clinical psychology, what kind of line of education do they have to go down? Just before we delve into the topic, because I know a lot of people like to kind of get the background about how to go about a certain course.
Of course, yeah, no problem. So I would have started with a degree in psychology, first of all. So that's usually 3 years, sometimes 4 years, depending on the university that you go to. And that's really a very basic introduction to psychology. At the time, I thought that was all I'd have to do. But you realize as you get onto the course that it really is, you're dipping your toe in the water, just learn about lots of different areas in psychology. And a lot of the focus is kind of on the theory behind psychology. And you do a thesis part of that. Then you would move on then to kind of more specialism. So generally for specialism, that's where the competition really, really comes in, because there's so few places. So most people would have done a master's. So I would have done applied psychology, which is another year. But you can go off in lots of different areas. Some people do things like occupational psychology and so on. And then after that, then if you want to be a clinical psychologist, then you have to go on to your doctorate in clinical psychology, which is another 3 years. And in between all of that, you also have to get work experience to get on to each course and apply multiple times to be told no, to pull yourself back together again and apply again every year. So it's demanding, hugely demanding. And you know what? I think sometimes it gives you an insight into what it's like for the people that come to see us, because you're constantly at high levels of stress and anxiety and just competing and always striving to get to the next stage.
well, it's amazing that you've got there and you put all the time and the work and the effort and the study into it as well. So congratulations to you, because it's, you know, I can imagine demanding for yourself and your own head, I suppose, and especially now having a little girl as well, must make life even more harder and stressful on yourself. And I know when we were trying to, I suppose, find a topic to speak to you about, because we could, I'd say, do 5 podcasts speaking to you on different topics, it's hard to narrow something down. But something that you do have a big interest is responsive caregiving. And so can you give us just a brief idea about what responsive caregiving is?
Yeah, sure. So this one might be a long one, so I'll do my best to keep it short. So I suppose for me, responsive caregiving is about being in tune with your baby or your child. And what I mean by that is really seeing them for who they are as an individual and recognizing that they have individual needs. So it's about understanding that our babies and our children are actually well able to communicate their needs to us, but sometimes we just have to know how to look and where to look. And I suppose a really big piece of responsive parenting is that you are consistently a secure base for your child, that they know that you'll give them unconditional love and that they can come to you for safety or for support when they need it. So it's really a very supportive approach of parenting. And I suppose now that I'm a parent, the way that I would explain it is that it's almost like you're parenting with your child rather than parenting to your child, if that makes sense. It's all about that back and forth relationship that both of you are involved in the parenting rather than just the parent. I think probably the biggest difference maybe that parents might notice between responsive parenting and more traditional types of parenting would be around how behavior is interpreted. So we'd often hear behavior looked at as good behavior and bad behavior. Like, we see that. But for responsive parenting, we don't look at it that way. We see that behavior is that. It's behavior. There's no good. There's no bad. All behavior is communicating something to us and it's telling us something. And I suppose rather than focusing on correction when we see a child behaving in a way that we don't like, it's more about trying to understand, okay, well, why are they doing that? What's happening for them right now? Trying to make sense of that for yourself and for them, and use it as an opportunity to teach them skills to kind of help them maybe cope with that situation or make more helpful choices the next time that they might be faced with it, if that makes sense. So I suppose it's really about kind of making space for the child and their particular needs as best as you can. And I guess we would kind of, I suppose, understand now with responsive parenting that the research tells us that a lot of the things we think young children should know, they don't know. Do you know? So we often hear parents say they know better than to do that. And we'd say, well, actually, no, they don't know better. They have to learn emotion regulation skills. They have to learn how to behave in different ways. And the best way for us to do that is to support them with that. They don't just automatically know that. So even if it's a child who's older and they know cognitively that, okay, I probably shouldn't have smashed that door, whatever it was, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not okay, you know, for them to do that. We need to help them to understand, okay, well, why did you do that? Okay, was that because you were feeling frustrated? And trying to understand the frustration and work with that first, and then look at why they might have smashed that door, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. And I think it's important as well for us not to, I think there's a massive stigma around, you know, a child having, let's say, air quotes, a tantrum in the middle of the shop or somewhere out and about. And you're just mortified, I assume, as a parent to say, oh my God, this child. And your first response is kind of maybe to pick the child up and remove them from the situation. You know, it should become more normalized that, okay, the child is having their moment and we just have to let them go through it because that's that emotion that they're feeling. There's no point in trying to explain to a child who's having, you know, like a reaction of frustration or anger, because at that present moment, their brain has shut down and all that they can do is focus on that one emotion. So do you think there should be more like we should normalize all behaviors, all types of emotions, and not be judging other parents if you see that happening in you know, out and about?
Definitely. And I think as much as we like to think we've moved away from it, I do think there is that sense of children should be seen and not heard. I think that still happens to some extent. And like tantrums are developmentally appropriate. And it's normally telling us that something's going on for the child. There's some unmet need. And it could be something as simple as they're hungry. But the way we view it, and I know I've been guilty of making a mistake, is that we look at the parent and we say, what are they doing wrong? You know, or they're just giving in, or that's a spoiled child. So we put all the blame on the parent when actually we don't need blame in that situation. We need to support the parent, you know, and also focus on, oh, like that's really tricky for that child. And I think we need to put ourselves in the shoes of little children and not put so much on them. Like what we expect of them is crazy when you think about it. They're small little people who are only learning everything about the world. And everything is new to them. And I can understand now, particularly now that I'm a mammy, I understand now where there's times where Lottie could get really, really inconsolably upset about something. And I'm trying to figure out what's wrong. And the more I'm trying to figure it out, the more she's getting frustrated and the more upset she's getting frustrated. But it's almost like we're speaking two different languages because she doesn't speak my language yet, you know, and I don't always understand her language. Sometimes I get it wrong and that's okay. You know, so I do think we need to be more supportive of that and recognize that it's not a reflection on the parent. You know, it's totally normal for children to get upset. And whether it's that there's a mismatch between their needs or they're struggling to communicate what they need, or like any of us, they're having a bad day. We all have bad days, but they haven't had an opportunity to learn coping skills yet. So, of course, they're going to get upset.
And from, I suppose, a point of view of somebody who has worked in a childcare setting over the years as well, what I found each year is that you need to reassess, I suppose, for each child, like what might work for one child isn't going to work for another child. So parents who have siblings or, you know, multiple children, maybe it's best for them to say, okay, well, just because it worked for my first child doesn't mean that it's going to work with the second one. And you nearly know from the morning, like we have kids in here that could spend 9 to 10 hours with us every day. And you know, when they come in the morning, we know them so well now, they're saying there is something wrong there, or they're tired, or they're hungry, or they're, you know, there's something maybe went wrong this morning coming out the door, and they come in now and they need a few minutes to settle themselves, you know. And I think sometimes as well, we always speak about the communication between us and the parents. It's so important for us to know kind of what has went on, you know, just so that we can, I suppose, if the child does have a tantrum or if they're having a bad day, that we know, okay, that there is something behind that behavior and we're not trying to figure it out ourselves. You know, looking at it from our point of view, if you have a class of 15 to 22 preschoolers and they're at an age where they're kind of figuring out their emotions, they're figuring out how to make relationships and form relationships with their peers, and there's so much going on for them, you know, if you really kind of take a step back and kind of look at it, and then something goes wrong for them, or they want a toy that their other friend has or whichever, and then they kind of act out. It's very difficult for us sometimes because parents may have a different kind of parenting technique, and I suppose I don't know if you've seen that in your line of work, where the importance of the connection between the parents and the caregivers of the children, we'll say the early years educators.
Yeah, I think that's a huge thing, Jennifer. And I suppose, obviously, I'm on maternity leave at the moment, but when I'm working, because I work with children and parents, often I end up going into schools and preschools and creches to do observations and to link in with staff. And for me, the biggest thing that makes the biggest difference for any child is consistency between what's happening in their childcare service and also at home. So building that relationship early on is so, so important. And, you know, I think that helps parents sometimes too as well, that if they feel like you're all on the same page and you're in it together, because, you know, I can imagine it's hard for a parent if they have been working all day and they've had a very stressful day and they come to creche to pick up their child, and they're met with a staff member who obviously has to tell them how the child's day went, but the child didn't have a good day. You know, I think if there isn't a good relationship between the staff member and the parent, that I think sometimes that can almost feel like to the parent, they might be being told that they're a bad parent, or it's your fault, or off you go now, you need to do this and just fix that. But if there's more of a kind of supportive relationship from the staff with the parents, I think parents take that information on board much easier. And I find they're actually much more open with the staff then. They'll come in and tell you in advance that morning, look, they're going to have a bad day. because this happened, because they feel more comfortable sharing that information with staff rather than feeling like they have to hide that and just send them in. Do you know, I do think that makes a difference.
There's another layer to that too, because they could come into a environment where the staff has had a bad day and their delivery on how the child's day went could be seen as, I suppose, yeah, like a reflection, like they're a bad parent. So it's very important there, like you said, that the communication is continuously open, and you have to remember that I've had a bad day, but you know, Emma might have had a bad day, and then the child is also, like, the three of you could be having the same bad day. So it's important to just be open as an educator as well as a parent and say, look, it's been a stressful day for me as well today, so sorry if I'm a bit, you know, you know, frustrated as I'm delivering the day to you. But you know, in relation to parents then, and if they want to kind of reflect on their own style of parenting, what advice would you give for them in relation to being a responsive parent, and how can they kind of go about changing their own behaviors before they can help their child?
So I was thinking about this question, and one of the things I thought was, the biggest thing I think for me is that, first of all, they need to let go of word prisons. So what I mean by word prisons are your have to's, your shoulds, your musts, and all of that, because they're based on other people's expectations and what other people are saying you should do with your child. And like I've said, no child is the same. They're all individual. So there's no specific way of parenting. And I think being a responsive parent isn't necessarily the norm just yet in society. And other people's opinions about it can put parents off because they're feared of being judged. And I think it's important for parents to understand that responsive parenting isn't about giving in to a child. And it's often misunderstood as, you know, you're just giving in to them and you're spoiling them and giving them what they want. And of course, they're going to keep throwing a tantrum because you give in to them every time. That's not what it's about. I think it's important for parents to understand that responsive parenting is about showing up for your child, showing them compassion, showing them empathy, helping them to regulate themselves and all of that. And yes, that might look like you're giving in to them, but it's not, because after you've done that, then you'll do your teaching moments. Then you will help them to understand that, okay, well, when you did that, that wasn't okay. You know, that hurt somebody's feelings, or you damaged property, or whatever it might be. And then you'll teach them what they can do the next time. So it isn't about just giving in. And I think that's really, really important for parents to hold on to that. And I would always say to parents as well to sit down and have a conversation about how you want to parent. Why do you want to parent that way? Because it will make it so much easier in those situations where, I know as a parent now, you can be flustered. You know, you could be in the middle of a shopping center, something goes wrong, like I've been there, and Lottie will start crying and I'm trying to get everything ready. And of course, people are looking and you're thinking, oh, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And you'll just go for the quick fix, which could be, you know, just giving in to them or whatever that might be. And that's totally understandable too. We're all human. And sometimes that's what we need to do. But if there's the added pressure that we think other people might be looking and what will they think, then we're less likely to be able to follow through on what we're doing at home when we're out. And like I said, consistency is key. So try to hold on to that, that what you want to do and how you choose to parent is the most important thing. Let go of what other people think.
Yeah, and there's other parents in that shopping center who are nearly thanking you for your child having a tantrum because their child just had one maybe 5 minutes before you. So it's kind of like a cycle of life that way. But I suppose, you know, we'll say it's never too late to start, you know, helping your child regulate emotions. But is there a time where it's too early, or can you start from when they're, you know, maybe 6 months, just talking about emotions in a child friendly manner? I know they won't understand too much, but by the time their language skills comes in, they might have picked up something from you teaching about that.
Yeah. And this is what I find really interesting, because actually you can do it from the day they're born. And this sounds ridiculous. Because I know you're going to think, well, like the baby can't talk, you know, they don't have language, but they have behavior. So remember, all behavior is communication. So I would have done it from day one with my little one. So we can model very early on before our little ones have language, and we can model things for them. So say, for example, if Lottie was upset, I would mimic her. So I'd mimic her tone. So if she was upset, I think often we can kind of rush in and want to be really peppy and excited and happy to make them happy. You know, we've all been there, go, oh, it's okay. Well, don't worry. You know, we all do that. But actually, if we want to start teaching them emotion regulation, we can go, oh, that's so hard. Oh, you're really, really tired. You want to go to bed. So that's something as simple as changing your tone of voice. And what you're doing there is you're letting them know that you see their experience and you understand it. You see what's going on for them. Sure, they don't have the language and no, they can't communicate that with words yet, but they're trying. So you can do little things like that. The big thing that for me as a parent, my parenting choice that I've made is that it's the one thing I'll say never about. I will never leave her to cry it out. And that's not to shame parents or anything or judge parents who use that approach. Some parents do use that approach. But I suppose I look at it from a psychology perspective and as a responsive parent. And for me, if I leave her to cry it out, in time, yes, she might stop crying. Okay. And for some people, then it has worked. It's effective. But when I look at it from what we know in the research and what we know about a baby's brain development, is that our babies don't have the ability to learn to self-soothe themselves. They're not born with that. That's something that they learn. So all that they have learned is that I cry, but nothing happens. So that doesn't work. I'm not going to use that mode of communication anymore in that situation. But you've left them with all these feelings and emotions that they don't know how to deal with, if that makes sense. So I think that's something that we can do from very, very early on is soothe our little ones. And again, it's not spoiling them. You're helping them to regulate themselves and then you can put them back down again. But I think then as children get older, parents are the best models. And I think we overlook how powerful that is. You know, again, I don't know, is it an Irish thing or do parents do it generally where parents say they don't want their kids to know if they're having a bad day or they don't want them to know if they're stressed? And you know, obviously there's a balance. You don't want your child to be taking on your stress and your anxiety and all of that. But there's nothing wrong with saying to your child, I'm actually feeling really, really worried today because I have a big important meeting at work and that's giving me butterflies in my tummy and it makes me feel sick. You know, like it's normalizing that that's okay. Adults feel these things too. And you're describing the experience to help them to learn. And there are things that we can do on a daily basis with our little ones.
And you said there about the importance of, I suppose, letting the child know that you have those feelings as well and that those feelings are okay. And it's something that we do, we'll say, on a Monday morning or it could be any morning, the kids will come in and they, you know, could be tired or they could have tears or a tantrum at the door. And, you know, the parents have kind of nearly look mortified some of the time. And I'd say if it was socially acceptable, that would have been me this morning as well, crying at the thought of coming in, you know, which is what I was, especially after a long weekend. But it's so funny to see like the children that we'll say would have started when they were 2 years of age and now they're going to school. And I've been watching them over the last few weeks, and before, when they might have hit or bit or kicked their peer, they will actually stop now and they'll say, okay, I'm really angry at you right now. I'm just going to go over here, but I'm really mad at you. Or they'll say, I'm really sad. And it's like that vocalizing of their emotions. It's so funny to see from, and they'll put their hands down by their side and they said, I'm not going to hit you, but I want you to know that I'm really sad. You know, so it's very funny to, I suppose, see the progression of them starting to understand and realize those emotions as well.
That's incredible, Jennifer. Like, it just goes to show how quickly they've taken that on. Like, they're little kids who haven't gone to school yet, you know, and they can learn all of that. And, you know, I think we have to acknowledge as well that for our little ones, that is so hard. You know how you're saying that they'll, you know, hold the hands down by their side and that they're literally trying to hold themselves together, you know, because they do feel like they want to explode and they're working so, so hard. And I think it's important for us to remember that that isn't easy and they're not always going to get it right. Just like for adults, you know, there's oftentimes, I'm sure we've all let a roar or a shout out of us, you know, where we lose our temper because we can't hold it in anymore. And it's just that bit harder for them because they're only learning. They've had much less practice than we've had.
Like Jenny said, if it was socially acceptable, I'm sure there'd be a lot more people giving a shoulder here and there to their peers. But before I ask you the next question, Emma, I just want to kind of say that, you know, anything that we talk about from this question isn't a judgment on parents, because I'm going to talk a little bit about the childcare world. So you know, please note that we know parents as well have long hours at work, and this is their only form of childcare for some parents. So it's not any judgment. It's just more of a discussion. But, you know, children can spend hours in a childcare setting, whether it's a creche, a preschool, or with a childminder. And it could be, you know, an 8 o'clock to 6 o'clock or 9 to 5. It depends on the working hours. But how can we as educators ensure that we are responsive caregivers to that child while we are kind of stepping in, I suppose, as the role of the parent in that particular case? Because you spend so much time with them, you know, you just get to know them so well as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's a really important point, you know, that for children who do spend longer hours in childcare, parenting happens in a way at home, but also in a different way in the creche or in the preschool or whatever it may be. And it's important to kind of be working together on that. So I think one of the first things which we touched on earlier on is to have that good relationship with parents to make sure that you're kind of on the same page. And for me, it's about trying to recognize the individual needs of the children in the childcare service. Now, I know that's easier said than done. Okay. I know that, you know, I do go out to preschools and creches and schools and observe. But before I was ever a clinical psychologist, I tutored autistic children. So I would have been in these environments. So I know what it's like day to day. And I know how stressful it can be to kind of meet the needs of every child. But I think there's a couple of things that you can do. I think one is that if there's something that you're finding difficult with a child that you'd like parents to work on, open up that conversation. But open it up in a way that we're going to figure this out together. And the really important thing there is observation. And I know the staff in childcare settings, they're quite familiar with observation because obviously there's likes of Asher and things like that where you'd be looking at observation to see how children are developing. But this is kind of a different sort of observation where you're purposely looking at the child to see how do they communicate? What do they do in a situation that they're not happy in, that they don't like? What do they do when they might be feeling stressed? So you're trying to look for these behaviors and trying to make sense of them. And you're asking parents to do the same at home. And that can be so, so powerful because it's literally you're putting more heads together to get a really good sense of the child. And it sometimes could be the case that actually things are the exact same at home and in the childcare setting, and that's fine. But sometimes they're totally different as well. And I think how we deliver that to parents is really, really important because I think sometimes parents can see a few more problems at home, particularly in the evening, compared to childcare. And it's sometimes shocking, I think, for childcare staff if a parent says, well, they were doing this at home. Have you seen them do this? So say, for example, when they come home, they just get all their toys and they throw them all over the room. And the childcare staff member is saying, I've never seen them do that in here. They're always so good and they always tidied up. And that may be the truth. But just think about how you deliver that to parents because it can make parents feel like they're doing something bad and they're doing something wrong. So I think letting parents know that it's normal for a child to be different at home and in childcare. And because also don't forget, parents are taking the child home after they've had a really busy day in childcare. So they've got the really tired kids going home. Another thing I suppose is for childcare staff to really try and meet the child where they're at. And I think this can be tricky, particularly for the preschoolers who are getting near the age of going to school, where you're trying to get them ready. You know, there's certain things you would like them to be able to do to be independent going to school. So there is that pressure. And I think parents sometimes feel the pressure and they want you to have it all fixed so that their little one will be ready to walk in the door to school to make it easier. And that's not always how it goes. But it's important just to remember to meet the child where they're at. And I think that's particularly important with children who have additional needs. So say perhaps children who might be autistic or they might have sensory processing difficulties or they might have an intellectual disability. You know, situations like getting them to sit in circle time. I understand that you're trying to prepare them to sit in a classroom and join in group activities. And of course, it's a really, really important skill for them to learn. But if you put all your energy into just getting them to sit in their chair in circle time and they're really not happy about it, you're going to be exhausted as a staff member. Parents are going to get frustrated as well because their child is going to be upset. And I think sometimes we can be too focused on the end goal, which is getting them ready for school, and we miss the bits in between. So in those situations, I'd say, you know, this is where your observation comes in. Have a look, see what happens when you bring them to circle time. What happens? Do they want to run away immediately? Do they only want to run away if a particular child sits beside them? Do they only want to run away when it's really, really noisy? And try and focus your efforts on supporting them with those pieces rather than just getting them to sit in circle time. So I think kind of an older approach would be to give a child lots and lots of positive reinforcement for doing the behavior that you want to see, you know, so that if they're sitting in the chair in circle time and they stay there, that you're going to give them lots of praise. But that's going to completely ignore their unmet need. So it'd be far more effective to find out, well, actually, it's the noise that gets them. What can we do about that to support them with it, to make it more enjoyable for them? Because you don't want them just doing something because that's what they have to do. It will be nice for them to enjoy it as well and actually want to do it. So, you know, you could think about giving them a break from circle time, or if it's a child with sensory needs, maybe they need to use ear defenders or something like that. And I think that's far more of a supportive approach to take with them, if that makes sense. I think that kind of, it's that kind of piece of really trying to support the child to develop the skills that they need, rather than thinking about what does that look like? Okay, they're just going to sit in a chair, because what something looks like isn't always what's going on behind all of that. So I suppose a simple thing that caregiving staff can do is watch the language that they use with their children. And it's one that we automatically do. When we see a child upset, we often rush in and say, it's okay, or don't cry, or don't worry about that. Or an old school one would be, big girls and big boys, don't cry. You know, we've often said those things. And there's a good intention behind it. We are intending to try and make the child feel better. But actually, what we're doing there is we're invalidating their experience. So we don't realize it, but we're actually telling them that you don't need to cry about that. Or in a way, it's silly to be upset about that. Or why are you upset about that? That's not something to be upset about. So just being careful of our language can be really, really helpful. So rather than just trying to rush in to fix, the first thing I would say is always use your language to try and name what's happening for them. And it can sound really silly, but breaking it down so that you could say, oh, I can see you have tears. That makes me think that you're sad. I wonder why you're sad. And, you know, you might have to tell that story for them. And like we've said, they don't always have the language to explain it, but you can narrate what has happened to help them make sense of it. You know, so it could be, I see your tears. That tells me you're really, really sad. Wonder why you're sad. Oh, I think you might be sad because you really like that ball and it's not your turn to use that ball right now. What can we do? So you're trying to just use it in a really, really nice way to kind of work around that with the kids.
Exactly. And I think sometimes as educators, we need to take a step back and kind of say, okay, who is this activity actually benefiting? Is it me who wants it to be perfect? And what, you know, looks like a perfect circle time? And are the kids just hating it? You know what? I think definitely you need to go in and read the room. That's what we'd often say in here, that you can't really structure your day. You can't plan, you know, have a flexible plan that if the kids after dinner don't want to sit down and read a book, that okay, do they need to go outside and run around instead of doing this? So yeah, I think sometimes it's kind of like the perfect thing. And it's probably the same with parenting. You have this like perfect idea, but it never really goes to plan, and that's okay too. And I've definitely found over the years those hard conversations with parents where you do have maybe a red flag and you've done your observations and you kind of say, okay, look, I do have some concerns. And I suppose it's, you know, it's easy to let those conversations go and say, no, look, we'll give them another few months now and see if things improve. And then you're kind of nearing the end of the preschool term and they're going to school in September and you've kind of lost all that time during the year. So it's kind of better just to kind of say, okay, no, I'm going to have my observations here to kind of back up what I am saying, and I need to go to the parent. And as you say, like, it's nothing that we're doing wrong. It's nothing the parent is doing wrong. It's nothing, you know, that the child is doing wrong. It's just that they may need help in this certain area. And at the end of the day, to kind of remember that the parent has the last call and that they are the primary caregiver as well, so you're not taking that kind of role away from them as well. But yeah, that's what I have found definitely over the years, is it's better to have those conversations, you know. And you will kind of start to see that the parents, maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks down the line, will actually come to you and say, do you know what, you were right, I've seen that happening at home, or you know, I noticed this happened as well. And it's kind of forming that supportive and solid relationship with them as well. But just before we finish up, Emma, just, I suppose, in your experience, what impact can it have on a child if they're not receiving that responsive caregiving from the parents or the childcare educators?
So I suppose this varies from child to child, okay? But in a general sense, I suppose, the way I would look at it that is that if a child isn't exposed to responsive caregiving in some way, whether that's from parents or from a caregiver, or as I like to say, that one good person, I would feel that it reduces their opportunities to learn and develop emotion regulation and healthy coping skills, because that's what it's all about. You know, you're trying to use opportunities in daily living to teach them those things. And I suppose what I would see as a psychologist is that children who have less well-developed emotion regulation skills and coping skills, they're the children that we would see in time as they get older would really, really struggle with maybe stressful situations or really tough times, maybe even around exam time and things like that in secondary school. So I would feel that it can have an impact potentially going forward for the likes of mental health. So you might see that a child as a teenager or as an adult, they might encounter difficulty with anxiety or low mood because they just haven't had the same opportunity to learn those emotion regulation skills. And I think it's just important to point out to parents as well that I do think an awful lot of parents do actually take a responsive approach without actually realizing that they're doing it. You know, there could be little things that they're doing every day that is responsive to their child's needs. And when we're trying to do specifically a responsive parenting approach, we're really just being more focused on it and really, really trying to apply that method to our parenting. So it's not to say that parents who don't take a responsive approach, it's not that they're a bad parent or it's a bad way of parenting that they're doing. It's just a different way. And I suppose from my perspective, I just find that responsive parenting has the better outcomes, I would feel. You know, you're equipping children with skills that they need throughout life. And it's not just kind of around emotion regulation. It's around problem solving. It's around communication. There's so much more to it. It's just invaluable. And I just think it's, I suppose, children who've had responsive parenting, they've got that advantage over children who haven't had it.
And it's funny, oftentimes with the preschoolers and the, you know, older children in particular, they can actually teach the parents how to, you know, teach them how to regulate their emotions as well, because they've learned that in preschool or in school. But Emma, I definitely have so many more questions for you, so many more topics, and we definitely have to get you back on in the future to delve into some, you know, the world of psychology is huge. Before we let you go, can you just tell us where our listeners could find you online, or if you had a website?
Yep. So I'm on Instagram and I'm the Mothering Psychologist, all one word, on Instagram. So they can look for me there.
Brilliant, Emma. Thanks so much. And definitely your Instagram page gives a great insight into psychology. And especially since you're a parent now, a lot of parents can actually, you know, relate to you as well. So thanks for giving up your time. I know you're such a busy woman. So thanks a million. And as Aoife said, we'll definitely have you on again another time.
Thanks so much for having me, girls. It was absolutely a pleasure.
No worries, Emma. Have a great rest of your day.
Okay, bye.
As always, thank you for listening to this week's episode of Little Steps, Big Futures, the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, rate, and review. And if you would like to get in touch, please find us on Instagram and Facebook at Little Steps, Big Futures. See you next time.